Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Barack Obama has been portrayed as a revolutionary outsider and as an entirely new breed of candidate. However, our guest for this first hour of Focus 580, independent journalist Paul Street, takes a rather different view. He says, among other things, that the president really fits quite comfortably within the territory that's been staked out by the Democratic Party within the last, oh, say, 35 years. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking about some of what you will find in his book, Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics. The book was actually published before the election took place, but at the point where it seemed fairly certain that not only would he be the nominee, but it was very likely that indeed he would become the president. Paul Street says that it's not his intention to make this a negative book, and his criticism is not particularly directed at the president himself as much as it is directed at America's election system and our political culture. He is here visiting in our area. His host is AWARE, the local anti-war, anti-racism effort, and he took part in a panel discussion last night talking about Obama's first 100 days, and we're pleased that he could be here and spend a little time with us. And let me tell you a little bit more about him. He served as both the director of research and also vice president for research and planning at the Chicago Urban League from the year 2000 until 2005. He's authored four books, including this most recent one, Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics. He's a regular contributor to the ZNet website, and his articles and commentary have been published in a number of places, including the Chicago Tribune, In These Times, Dissent, Z Magazine, and a lot of other places as well. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions and comments brief, so we can get as many callers as possible into the program and keep things moving along. But, of course, anyone is welcome to call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. So, again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. And if it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David, for having me. I appreciate inviting me, and I look forward to comments from callers as well.
We were just, before we got started here, you said that you'd been doing a lot of things like this where the theme was first 100 days, and then you said, and really, that's not very much time to make a judgment on somebody.
Well, I tell you, you know, presidencies, you know, if they go 4 years, and if they're a success, they go 8. So, and the assessments continue indefinitely into subsequent decades, and historians evaluate. So, you know, we get new spins on the Roosevelt administration in the 30s. Every other year, there's a new monograph comes out. Lincoln is rehashed over and over again. That'll certainly happen with Obama. On the other hand, it's been fairly eventful, pivotal 100 days. You know, and there have been certain decisions that have been made, and and also the president-elect stage. Before that, after the election, a lot of key sort of indications in terms of transition team and cabinet appointments. So, you know, it's also been fairly eventful too. I don't want to pretend it's an irrelevant phase either.
I want to get your reflections just on the kinds of things that were said about him in the run-up to the election and afterwards, particularly a lot of this rather high-flying rhetoric about the fact that he was like something that we've just never seen before. And it seems that your assessment is, well, there might be some special things about him, but that in a lot of ways he's a Democrat like the Democrats that we've been seeing for some time now.
Well, I mean, the rhetoric, this has been going on for some time with the Republicans. They call anyone in the Democratic Party a socialist. I mean, how would Obama raise $38 million from the finance, insurance, and real estate industries and $1 million from Goldman Sachs and, you know, and gotten the kind of favorable coverage in a media that's 50% of which is owned by six corporations if he was a radical leftist? I mean, our election system is not exactly set up to promote radical enemies of capitalism. And you know, Obama's goes back to Harvard Law and has been a lot of strong relationships with leading in investment firms and in Chicago, New York, and all those kinds of things are very much in line with traditional American politics. And has been described not just on the left, but even by Larissa McFarquhar in The New Yorker and Ryan Lizza in The New Yorker and other mainstream journalists. John R. MacArthur, the president of Harper's Magazine, says, relatively speaking, a moderate middle of the road Democrat. And MacArthur says, with far too much respect, he says, for the global financial investor class, more than he ought to have. You know, so very much in the Clinton mode. I mean, it's dramatically new and extraordinarily historic that we have a black African American family in the White House, and someone with a technically Muslim name.
Well, when we were going through the campaign and we were getting closer, and then the point was we knew that he would be the nominee, and then he was elected. Were people really expecting, was there really good reason to expect that he would be, say, dramatically different from Bill Clinton, or that in a lot of ways he would be very similar to Bill Clinton?
Oh, there were all kind of indications of similarity in positions that were taken on a various number of issues, including Iraq, actually there was kind of a myth that Obama was this really sort of militantly anti-war president, which in my book, Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics, I really dissect in a very detailed kind of way and go through Obama's various positions. And it's he's always watching and managing himself in an extremely careful kind of way to be taking middle-of-the-road kinds of positions. He certainly did that on Iraq. He's done that on all kinds of issue areas.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to cast you in a position of being representing everybody who's on the left side of the political spectrum in their assessment of the president. But right. What would you say, for what we've seen so far, from the perspective of somebody who's on the left, how would you say, you know, how would you look at what he did, what he didn't do, and what's your general assessment?
Well, you know, there's this myth, and if you listen to Fox News, and there's this fellow Bernard Goldberg, who's a very right-wing commentator, sells a lot of books in this country, and I've heard it over and over again that all the left is hopelessly in love with Obama, and I can reel off a list of names, not just myself, Glenn Ford, Margaret Kimberly, Noam Chomsky, Joshua Frank, Pam Martins, Michael Hudson, Chris Hedges. I mean, the list goes on of people who have been significantly critical of Obama, both before and since the election, from the left. And, you know, it particularly the sending out the clear policy signals that he's going to continue indefinitely the occupation of Iraq is something that the left, whatever exactly we want to describe that category, is not happy with at all. The increase in the escalation of imperial violence in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and in fact the merging of both of those into one theater now explicitly called AFPAC, and a lot of kind of Cold War domino theory type of language about Al-Qaeda and Taliban are just going to take over both of these countries and they're going to be attacking our shores again is not something that people I know on the left are pleased with. The left is not pleased with the failure to undertake a forceful investigation of the Bush administration on the torture practices and these repeated statements coming out of the Obama administration that would be dysfunctional, focus on the past. You know, if we were to get really serious about, I might say not just the torture practices, but also there needs to be an investigation of the selling of the Iraq war in the first place, which was monumentally illegal, and the bailouts of the leading Wall Street financial institutions and the billions and indeed trillions of dollars that have essentially been released to keep Wall Street perpetrators afloat, and the reluctance to engage in the forceful kind of nationalizations and the restructurings in the financial industries, which a lot of us, we get accused of being cynical of, connect to some of the campaign funding and the incredible powerful role that Wall Street banks play. Obama was very strongly connected to and funded by firms like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and so forth, and the left's not happy with that, nor do we like the resort to supplemental funding of the Afghan and the Iraq wars, which was a sort of deceptive war funding method that Obama was very critical of when Bush did it and said he wasn't going to do it anymore. And in fact, we have a Pentagon budget where we're going to continue to spend, in fact, we're going up a little bit, $1 trillion a year on what our official political culture likes to call defense, and I always call it the empire budget because we support more than 760 bases in 130 countries. And, of course, we have a lot of issues. I could go on and on with U.S. policy in the Middle East in general with regard to Israel and Palestine and our alliance with dictatorship like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and so forth.
Yeah. We have a caller. Why don't we, and rather than make this person wait, we'll get right to them.
Sure.
Someone in Champaign and on line number one. Hello.
Oh, you could have made me wait. That was okay. perhaps I'm being a bit pedantic here, just a bit of trivia. It struck me funny this week that Wednesday was touted as being his 100th day. I would invite anyone listening to look at a calendar and sum up the number of days between Wednesday and January 20th. It's actually 99, and you know, perhaps with a recession now, you know, 100 is now 99. But anyway, myself, just to make a comment about Obama, is I'm extremely disappointed with what he's done so far. He's, as far as I can see, he looks like Clinton version 2.0 and 2.0, and which I wouldn't consider to be a compliment, because Clinton was basically Ronald Reagan light. You know, he was Ronald Reagan with a lechery problem, basically. I think a lot of people that voted for Obama, and myself included, were expecting him to come into Washington with a broom, kick a few bottoms, take some names, and clean the place up. And so far as I can see, especially with regard to things like labor and the way the working class, you know, the blue collar people are being treated, it's a republic, it's Reagan again, you know, there's no change there. It just seems to be the status quo goes on, and I think as time goes on, a lot of other people, you know, that have been waiting for this and waiting for that are going to be extremely disappointed too. The only thing he's done so far that I would applaud was the fact that he's embraced science with regard to stem cell research, and that's been it. It's otherwise he ain't a whole lot different than the people that have held the office for the last 30 years, you know. So if you'd like to comment on it, please, and thank you.
All right.
I'm going to give Obama some credit for, I like the easing of the ban on stem cell research. Scrapping the global gag rule on abortion counseling was a good thing. We've ended White House denial of climate change. There was an expansion of children's health insurance, and some lands have been set aside for environmental protection. I mean, there are some key areas. I don't want to sound too overly harsh and too negative. The caller cited workers' issues and labor issues. Obama has said that he will pass this absolutely critical and overdue, he would sign it, labor law reform bill called the Employee Free Choice Act, which is a very important piece of legislation to me, and which would essentially re-legalize unions in this country. It would go a long way towards it. Right now, people are just fired left and right routinely for trying to organize unions, and that's why we're down to 7.5% of the private sector workforce actually is enrolled in unions anymore. Actually, most working people want to be in them. But he hasn't really highlighted employee free choice at all. He's Obama's largely mute on it. He's very attuned to fierce business class opposition to it. And I agree with Noam Chomsky that if we were really serious about a progressive economic recovery program, we would have that particular bill at the heart and the center of it. It wouldn't just be something we didn't talk about. In terms of being disappointed, I think a lot of progressive activists have little business being disappointed, because if you read my book, I go through about 85 different ways in which Obama clearly sent the signal, you know, all the way down to the people he's had around him, like James Jones, his national security advisor, Lawrence Summers, his top economic advisor, is a leading corporate neoliberal economist who was involved in the deregulation of the financial industry in really key kinds of ways in the 1990s. I think more advanced left sort of activist intellectuals have little reason being fooled. But I'm from Iowa, and I did see the campaign, and he really did, for rank and file, to the liberal base in Iowa and in New Hampshire, and I suppose in Illinois, he really did run as a kind of Mr. Smith is going to go to Washington and clean up the big corporate mess kind of thing. There really was a kind of deception of a certain part of the population. The caller mentioned Bill Clinton, who undertook a slashing of welfare benefits, a so-called welfare reform, which I was called welfare elimination in the 90s. that many of us on the left were horrified by, I think with good reasons. And Obama has repeatedly praised that welfare elimination as a great policy success. He does in his book Audacity of Hope, and he has on the he did on the campaign trail. And I think that's very indicative of the kind of centrist tent and sort of conservative orientation of Obama. And that's a real issue right now as we hit this great recession. We don't have a family public cash assistance system that is capable of expanding at the federal and the state level to match the rise of destitution as we head towards double-digit unemployment. And I wish he'd change his line on that, because that was not all that progressive a thing.
Well, we talked at the beginning about the fact that we're only, it's like a little over 3 months into the administration.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, no telling what's going to happen. But it sounds as if what you're saying for somebody who would say, well, be patient and let's see how things develop, it sounds like you would say, well, we got a pretty good idea. You would say, I have a
some
pretty
areas.
Good idea in some areas how he feels. So it's not like we're going to have to wait another year or something before we see.
Well, you know, we didn't have any idea that how far left FDR was going to go in the 1930s. Actually started off relatively centrist and relatively conservative. And, you know, the big code phrase now is pragmatic. FDR was mm-hmm. kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
And by 35 and 36, we have what was called the Second New Deal, with really significant – we get the Social Security Act. We get the Wagner Act, which essentially legalized unions in this country in the 30s. And we get some – in the Public Works Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and we get some really significant kind of progressive movements. But what people sometimes forget sometimes, and they're hoping for a new deal under Obama, is people didn't get that stuff by begging FDR for it. They got that stuff by hitting the streets. They engaged in sit-down strikes and general strikes and anti-eviction movements. So, you know, engage in direct action in a citizen politics between and across these big sort of candidate-centered quadrennial electoral extravaganzas, you know, every 4 years, that we kind of in this country are conditioned to see as the sum definition of politics. My book is actually not so much a critique of Obama per se. And a lot of my issues with Iowa City liberals, I'm from Iowa City, isn't so much that they just got too into Obama. I think they did to a certain extent. But that they got too into kind of candidate-centered politics. And they go, that's it. It's like Chomsky says. Noam Chomsky says, you know, that's under the official doctrine, that's politics. These mm-hmm. elections. Well, there's a politics every day that we tend to forget about. And that's a lot of how the 30s happened and how the good and more progressive aspects of the New Deal happened with everyday politics. I think it's part of how the civil rights movement happened, and how the Vietnam War was ended. Yeah. You know, day to day politics.
Well, I think that's really an interesting point, and raises this the question. I think, what does it take to get people to mobilize and become active that way politically? And I think a lot of people have said, you know, it's really surprising that I'm not saying that there was no anti Iraq War movement, but it was nothing like the anti-Vietnam War movement.
Right.
And that now people, you know, given the fact that this is the worst the economy's been since the Great Depression, people are not out in the streets demonstrating for workers' rights or for greater support for people who are having a hard time or for help for people who've lost their mortgage because of unscrupulous lenders and all that kind of stuff. I mean, so then that gets the question, well, what is it that it would take to actually get people out like that?
Well, you know, and in the 30s, people forget. There's a lot of 30s FDR and Obama analogies going around right now. But people forget when Roosevelt came in, they were literally at 25% unemployment. I mean, it was truly – people thought capitalism was done. I mean, it was a absolutely monumental crisis. And we're freaking out because we're probably heading towards double-digit unemployment. Mm-hmm. Now, we've been at double-digit unemployment in the black community already. But, you know, I tell you, in some ways, this ought to be a left organizer's paradise right now. And there is a language out there. There's a discourse out there. There's something I'm hearing a lot. You hear it at lunch counters. You hear it at taverns. You hear it on job sites. And it's this refrain. It's kind of ruefully stated. Where's my bailout? And again and again. And there is a sense, and this is kind of 30s-like, that this economy went down the tubes and it was driven over the cliff by them, by these elites in Wall Street, which is kind of very 30s-like. And there's a kind of sense that, you know, if I'm unemployed, it's not necessarily my fault, which is sort of the typical American response. Everyone kind of blames themselves all the time. And that's interesting. And I expect that to go somewhere. There is a kind of populist rage out there. What I worry about is with the left being so institutionally kind of marginalized and weak, we don't have left parties and institutions in this country to the same extent we have in other industrialized states where they are marching. You know, unions are stronger, left, independent, third, fourth, fifth parties are stronger, and they are mobilizing people, and they are taking to the streets, and we don't have that for various reasons in this country, and the right could suck up a lot of that, and that sort of populist anger, and you could sort of have a populist rebellion on the right if the Republican Party could ever get its head together and figure out how to mobilize that, and we've got to be careful.
And I think that people will probably be prepared to argue that that's already started to happen. At least that is that the right has sucked up a lot of that populist anger. And that it's more, you know, and it may be it has something to do with the nature of American media, that those are the kinds of voices that you hear, and that's the kind of political commentary that you hear an awful lot. And there is some kind of foment like that going on over on the right side of the political spectrum, and not so much on the left.
Not very much. And one thing that is kind of disturbing is the extent to which a lot of liberal and progressives and left people do seem to, I worry about this, they get a little overly captivated by the Obama phenomena. And that's might even, even on the campaign trail itself, Edwards and Obama repeatedly in Iowa said change comes from the bottom up. It doesn't come from the top down. At one point in the campaign, I think it was in New Hampshire, Obama was being pressed by an activist in one of the town hall meetings. And he said, you know, and he quoted the famous FDR story where FDR was talking to a bunch of labor leaders who in the early 30s, just as he came into office, and they had, of course, this ambitious agenda, and they wanted to do all kinds of things, some of which he did, progressive, liberal, social reform. He said, make me do it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that was one of, I thought, Obama's better moments when he said that. And he was a community organizer for a couple of years, and he sort of knows that kind of basic kind of Saul Alinsky community organizer's mentality, that there's this day-to-day politics, and you have to force change from the bottom up. And a lot of what passes for a left in this country right now seems overly captivated. Maybe they're overly scared of some of that populist reaction on the right that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. But some of them, like I think of MoveOn.org, I don't even know if it almost seems to be disbanding itself as an anti-war organization. It seems to just be in Obama's hip pocket. And there's a history of that in certain parts of what passes for a left in this country, of just subordinating yourself to whoever the top Democratic politicians at the time are. We certainly saw some of that with Clinton.
We're already at our midpoint. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Paul Street. He's a journalist, a political commentator. He's authored a number of books. His most recent is Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics. He also has written for a number of publications. His work has appeared in a number of publications, among them the Chicago Tribune, also In These Times, Dissent, Z Magazine, Alternet, and he's also a regular commentator for the ZNet website. He was here visiting in Champaign-Urbana, took part in a forum last night talking about the first 100 days of the Obama administration. His host here in Champaign-Urbana, the folks involved in the organization AWARE, the anti-war, anti-racism effort. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. As you've said, I think people will get the idea that certainly you have some criticism for the president, and some things that you would say you would give him good marks for, other things not. But that a lot of what really the book is has to do with the subtitle, The Future of American Politics. I think that there are some people who would say, well, if you look at American politics, you know, occasionally we get swings one way or another, but that it's natural that for American people, their natural resting point on the political spectrum is kind of to the right of the center. And that to get them to nudge them over on the other side is real tough. It's happened. Maybe the last time that it really happened was, well, maybe it had happened in the 1960s. Certainly it happened in the 1930s. But that their natural point is not on the left. It's, as I say, it's slightly to the right of the center. Can you give any credence to that kind of analysis?
You know, I don't. Well, it depends on how you define some of those terms. I think we have shifted back from the kind of hard right lurch we took after 9/11 back towards the center in this country. And while I'm concerned about people becoming pacified and not pushing for the kind of economic and, well, broad range of reforms that we need to push for, I think that's a welcome development. I think we were in a dangerous kind of space. I and Zenet and me and a number of authors used to kind of almost use the would use the phrase of proto-fascist to describe some of the directions we were moving in 03 and 04. I don't know if it's just Obama that did that. I think there was a shift back towards the center actually in the second Bush administration. There was already a standing down from some of the really extreme kinds of measures, and they got rid of Rumsfeld. I suspect historians years from now will be looking back on the shift back to the center that started taking place in 05 and 06, congressional elections in 06. We're part of that. You know, in terms of where people are ideologically, there's a disconnect between what people tell pollsters on specific issues and how they identify themselves ideologically. Yeah. I've done a fair amount of writing about this and looked at a lot of survey data. And I'll tell you, when you get down to issues and you get into things like healthcare, I mean, where actually majorities will end up supporting single-payer Canadian-style, European-style national health insurance, union rights, the United States' role in the world, do corporations have too much power in American life and in American politics? Most Americans forever have been telling pollsters that they think that. Do they like the kind of distribution of wealth that exists in this country where 1% of the population owns 40% of the wealth? No, they hate it. They think there ought to be a more equal distribution of wealth. They large majorities for a long time have said we spend too much money on the Pentagon budget and should spend more on social expenditure. So on issues, it's extraordinary. People come across in this country as social democrats and really good liberal progressive internationalists in international relations, but it doesn't translate into identifying themselves as social democrats all that much certainly as left. And I think that has to do with the paucity, just sort of the absence in the American electoral system of institutions that would capture that kind of sentiment. I taught for years in various places, including Northern Illinois University, and I'd have communications with students, and they'd have these kinds of progressive, actually kind of left attitudes about things, but they thought they were like freaks for having them. You know, they think we ought to have national health insurance. They must be crazy. You know, they don't. They think U.S. should always obey international law and shouldn't invade countries aggressively, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you could just go down the list. And they thought those were really bizarre attitudes. And I'd show them survey data. I said, actually, you're in a majority here. And they were just amazed. Well, you don't hear much about it in corporate media, about how that's actually a mainstream attitude. We have a lot of left policy attitudes and don't know it.
Well, let's talk with some more folks here. Let's go to Kankakee for the next caller. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. I'm proud of America that we were able to set our differences aside and elect somebody like Barack Obama. But the problem is, I don't think it's Barack Obama. He's a well-educated, well-groomed speaker, and I like a lot of his ideas. The problem is, it's the people under him. People have to remember, the president of the United States doesn't run this country. It's the Congress and the Senate. Am I not correct? And the problem I see is that the way we elect our officials, the election itself, I don't trust it. Sometimes I think it's rigged the way it comes out. Now, the reason I say this is if we had no tags, like if there was no Democrat or Republican or independent party or whatnot, and we were electing these officials solely on their education and their knowledge of politics, I think a lot of these problems we have today in American society and a lot of American politics wouldn't be there. And then the other thing is, too, is the money aspect. I laugh when I hear my friends who are politicians talk about saving money, cutting back and doing all this at the same time that they're passing bills that seem to cost billions and billions of dollars for frivolous stuff, like the Alaskan Highway to Nowhere. If people get online and educate themselves more often about what the Congress, you know, what our politicians do on a daily basis, maybe they'd think twice about electing people. And that's my comment. Thank you.
All right. Well, okay. I expect that you would agree with substantially with a lot
of
what the caller had to say. Or some of it, at least.
Though I would caution that the executive branch has a lot of autonomous policymaking power. Particularly, so it isn't just about, Congress and Senate just doesn't run everything. There's all kinds of direct policies that executive orders and particularly in the realm of foreign policy. The executive branch makes foreign policy to a very significant degree. And there's a lot of direct space for executive branch interventions in this financial crisis. Some things have had to be done with Congress, but many things haven't. And a lot of things have been done working through the Fed and working directly through the Treasury Department. So, I mean, who is in the presidency matters a lot. It isn't like they're just irrelevant and controlled by Congress. I think the point on money is absolutely critical. I'm sort of a different spin on it. But I've been forever an advocate of full public financing of elections. I think private money has to come out of public elections. I was very upset with Obama's campaign claim. Obama essentially blew up. We're not going to see it again, the public presidential campaign finance
right.
system. He just blew right through it, and it's as far as I can tell, it's absolutely gone. And he had this, I thought, very disingenuous campaign line that, well, we have a parallel public financing system with all our small donors. People out there in listening land, Obama's percentage of contributors that were small donors was no different than George W. Bush's percentage of contributors that were small donors in 2004. It was just as weighted towards big donors. And when you look at the campaign funding profile, guess what? It's still predominantly rich folks, and you have big overrepresentation for the Wall Street firms. That's the people that's under Obama, but he picks a lot of the people under him in the cabinet, and we had a number of more liberal and progressive economic minds that might have been part of this economic crisis team that seemed to have been blacklisted. We could have had Joseph Stiglitz. We might have had Paul Krugman. I could go through a list of names of fairly progressive economic minds who probably would not have been in support of these big bailouts. And we didn't go with those. We went with Timothy Geithner and Lawrence Summers and a whole bunch of people that if you looked at their careers, you could be pretty sure you're going to have a lot of this more sort of corporate-friendly type of stuff that's been happening.
Well, as I've said a couple times, that a lot of what the Barack Obama and the future of American politics is, it's a critique of American politics. And,
oh, absolutely.
As much or maybe more than it is of Barack Obama. So,
if Hillary Clinton was the president, we'd have all these issues,
sure.
maybe a few more.
So, one of the central issues, and I'm sure that you think about and a lot of people think about and have been talking about for some time, is that when people do go to the polls, what sort of choices do they have?
Yeah.
And the standard sort of complaint, the common complaint, is that the people there essentially are all clustered around the middle, maybe one, a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left, but their attitudes are not that different and certainly don't reflect the wide spectrum of politics. So if someone wanted to cast a very different vote, very different choice, the choices are limited.
And changing that, it would be not so much about carping about any particular candidates. I mean, I even think I ended up in Iowa liking Edwards. I mean, because I'm left of Kucinich, but I'm sort of liking Edwards because he talks so much about labor rights. But I'm not sure even with him in the White House, we wouldn't be seeing all this incredibly frustrating drift to the corporate center, and we'd have a lot of the same foreign policy issues. And at the end of the day, it ends up not being so much about those candidates or he's not a candidate, he's a president, as changing the incentive structure that we have mm-hmm. within our political system and opening up space. And I'm not sure that wouldn't involve darn near a constitutional amendment. I advocate that, actually. We need a democracy amendment that would create a different kind of incentive structure and be a huge production to have that. But I think very significant reforms would open up space for third parties. And I also think it's probably a matter of media reform. I mean, it's where we shrink the number of corporations that own our airwave spectrum. And it seems like every 5 years a new study comes out. It's like 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5 corporations control more than half the media. And that's a really underestimated issue for people.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone next in here where we are, a couple of callers. First, someone in Champaign. And this is line one. Hello.
Morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to make two points, I think. One is that I think I style myself as a progressive, in my view, like a Fabian socialist, even, if you will. But I think that Obama's procedure was essentially like one thing he had to do was he had to keep the ship afloat in terms of using a lot of his energy to keep the capitalist system from going completely haywire, off a cliff. I think that impacted on how he governed in the first 100 days. Another thing I'd like to maintain is this guy's more intelligent than just about anybody that critiques him and more understanding of the political process than anybody critiques him. And then the third point I'd make is that I think he mentioned Goodwin's book about Team of Rivals, and with Lincoln's central tenet that politically anything is possible with the people's will behind you, and without the people's will, nothing can be done, roughly speaking. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. I think Obama would move things further to the left if he thought it was politically possible. But what he's doing, I think, is steering the ship as far to the left as he thinks he can at the point that he's at. What do you think?
On intelligence, Obama is highly intelligent. It's the most intelligent president we've ever had, I would be my guess. Lincoln.
Yeah, Lincoln.
Lincoln was extreme. Woodrow Wilson was very bright. Kennedy was actually was very intelligent. I think that's.
So was Carter.
I guess. I don't know. Yeah, I could tell you, Carter's been a heck of an expert, and he's been very courageous in a lot of ways in his willingness to discuss issues regarding Israel in Palestine. In terms of being, intelligent on the political process, I always say I never am. When I speak in political, gatherings about Obama, I never doubt for a second that Obama and his team are masterful political actors, and they are in everything they're doing that I disapprove of, is richly incentivized within the existing political system, which does push you to the center in all kinds of ways: money and media, the power of the foreign policy establishment, and so on and so forth. Insofar as I have a moral critique of that, it isn't that he's doing the wrong things from the perspective of seeking glory and advancement of the political system. Rather, Dr. Martin Luther King, who was highly intelligent and somehow had a lot of impact on me when I was a kid, was approached to run for the presidency in 67 and said, "That's not what I'm about. That's not what I want to do." I actually am not a fan of running for president. I actually think when someone has the brain power and the capacity and the charisma and the organizing background and so forth that Obama does, that he does more service to the communities he purports to represent by being an activist sort of outside the system. I'm actually not about running for the president because I think that all these things that he's doing are exactly right. That's what happens to you. You get in and you get immersed in that. And instead of staying outside and advocating for a change in the structure of the political system and, in fact, in the structure of the society as a whole, this thing about the people's will, that's absolutely right. One thing about this 100 days thing that is early, we could still see Obama push to the left. The problem is so many folks in what passes for a left in this country seem to be not getting what that politics is that would push him to do that. So, for example, Paul Krugman has become this great symbol of left critique of Obama, but repeatedly writes columns in the Times that end with this phrase, "We can only hope he'll be more progressive." Well, that's not how the 30s happened, and it sure isn't how the 60s happened, by progressives going, "Oh, let's just hope that he does the right things." My goodness. we gotta get better. We gotta be better than that.
Can I make a final comment?
Yeah, sure.
I think that some of your critiques of and the way you speak of Obama's administration and his moral center and his moral drives are pejorative. I mean, I think you're slanting things negatively against him, just the way you speak, and I disagree with that characterization. But, you're welcome to it. And a lot of things you say I agree with. Thank you.
All right. Well,
I'm not sure. I don't know how to respond to the pejorative. I mean, if you have a criticism, it's pejorative. I'm wondering if this caller was referring to things they've read by me or if they know my writings. Otherwise, sometimes when a lot of the writings that show up in Black Agenda Report get, I'll tell you, there's no one that goes after Obama like the black left. And some of the commentary that comes up in the comment section gets pretty mean. It does get kind of mean-spirited at the time. I think you're right, Dave, when you were characterizing my book as saying that it's not really a critique of Obama per se. It's about the structure within which he's operating. I think we need to re-incentivize the political structures in this country so that a John Edwards or an Obama or a Hillary. You know, let's face it, politicians are just tend to be, if you think you've got the stuff to be the president, you should do that. You're probably a somewhat narcissistic human being at a certain level. I mean, I'm not a big fan of politicians per se, but we could use their narcissism, or we could use their sort of aggrandized sense of their self by incentivizing them to act more in accord with the majority progressive values for things like single-payer national health insurance. Well, we could do that. We could use them.
I got somebody else here I want to get to. But just real quick, I guess I wonder about your reflection on one of the comments that the caller made. And I expect that probably it's the kind of thing that you hear a lot and that people on the left say is that say about people who maybe might make the criticisms, kind of criticisms that you have of the president, is that they say something like, well, you know, he's doing what's politically possible. So, you know, quit complaining and because, you know, he's doing what he can do because that's the, you know, it's the old thing about how it's United States is it's an ocean liner. It's not a motorboat. So, you know, you can't turn things around quickly.
Yeah. Well, no, I think in large measure that's largely true. Though I've heard him say that a lot about single payer health insurance. And I think about Medicaid in 64 and 65, which is basically single payer for everyone over 65. Yeah. And I'll tell you, it was done in, of course, it was the 60s, but it was done in about a year. And it's one of the great policy successes. So you can turn around things pretty fast sometimes. But yeah, he is operating within a system. What's possible? And I guess my point is I want charismatic public personalities who can command audiences like Obama can, maybe to be, maybe not Obama per se, but to be pursuing a change in the definition of what's politically possible. That probably involves political reform and political change from the bottom up, from the outside. And frankly, that's not about running for president. Yeah. That's not what that's about. That's about something else.
About 10 minutes left here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Paul Street. He's a journalist, political commentator. His most recent book is Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics. Questions welcome, 333-9455.
Can I add one thing on that?
Yeah.
The other thing, yeah, he does operate oftentimes within the realm of only within the realm of the possible. Sometimes Obama has gone really beyond the call of duty of what is required by the ruling class or whoever you want to say. And I think particularly of his vote in the 2005 in the Senate to make it more difficult for people to sue corporations and bank and get reasonable compensation through through class action lawsuits. I don't think that, you know, I could go through, I've got a number of them in my book, examples of that. Mm-hmm. Number of things that just really weren't required. There's some of these aspects of this torture policy I don't think are absolutely these strange and creepy comments on torture. That, you know, that it'd be dysfunctional to focus, that we'd only be focusing on the past. I don't think that's really required. I think he could be better on that. I've got a few areas on that.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else here. Next caller will be in Urbana. We'll be in Champaign, I believe, in line one. Hello. Yes, go ahead. The caller there.
Did you lose him?
Line one, Champaign.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. I kind of started listening a little bit late, and I hope. And I'm driving, so my concentration is.
Be careful.
yeah, thank you. Your guest this morning shows a lot of knowledge, lots of good things when he says about the people surrounding Obama. How sad is that some people consider this. Obama, the most urgent president in the United States, how sad for America the last 250 years. But really, we had a terrible, terrible choices. Unfortunately, when you have a one-party system, Democrats or Republicans, you have those choices. The money are behind those. And however, I haven't heard, maybe that was the beginning of the conversation, but haven't heard that since he got... in Harvard Law School, I don't know, affirmative action or not, under the wings of Brzezinski and Kissinger, actually, he was groomed to be one day in a front line when people got exhausted and tired and frustrated with faces like Bush's, etc., to throw a different face. Can you please tell me something? What do you think about the connections? And last year, before the election, dinners with Burks and trilaterals, etc. And it's really very sad that people like this, with help of, because the Constitution doesn't give the power to the president, the American Constitution gives the power to the Congress, to the people. Unfortunately, we have the most corrupt Congress, and that's why it's, they're shredding the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and all of this. But what do you think? Is there hope for a third party, which is the only hope we have? Is this visible in today's environment? Big corporate. We're living in socialism the last 100 years in America since the Woodrow Wilson Federal Reserve Act and Roosevelt New Deal.
Yeah, let me get to some comments here from our guest, because y'all has raised a number of points.
You know, I did miss some of that because I think we were getting a little garbled with with driving in the phone. He raised the issue of there was a hint of conspiracy theory in some of those commentaries, in some of that question. There was a connection with Brzezinski, you know, who was of course Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, and who was the a very unapologetic architect of a lot of what's happened in Afghanistan in the last years. And he continues to this day to be very proud of what took place in Afghanistan, because you know the Afghanistan war that we sponsored and we in some ways built, you know, the forces that led to became Al-Qaeda and the Taliban to collapse the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. But now sort of the boomerang backlash or the blowback of that, it's really awful. And Brzezinski was over the years a theoretician of U.S. power in the Middle East and used to talk about critical leverage and how important it is for us to have control and power over Middle Eastern oil in terms of the critical leverage it gives us over the rest of the world, which a lot of people thought was part of the invasion of Iraq. And there's some creepy energy around Brzezinski, and I believe Brzezinski was around Columbia when Obama was an undergraduate getting a degree in international relations. And there's a lot of conspiracy theory buzz about Obama's connection with Brzezinski as a young man. I really know very little about it. The people around him, there's a lot of people around him that have been fairly imperial. You know, it's very much in accord with Brzezinski and all of that. His national security advisor right now, Obama's, is a guy named James Jones, who was the head of NATO, and who's one of his key hallmark aspects of his career is that the U.S. needs to increase its control, and NATO needs to increase its control over strategic Middle Eastern oil reserves. And you go through all these lists of people that are around Obama, and he says, well, and he said this, you know, don't worry about these folks around me. I will provide the progressive vision, you know, that in accord with my campaign rhetoric. Well, you know, saying that, you take a lot of these people, Lawrence Summers, Timothy Geithner, James Jones, Hillary Clinton, say, I'm going to provide the progressive vision that's going to make these people really move in these directions in my campaign. It's kind of like a baseball manager. It's kind of like a baseball manager saying, I'm going to have a team based on speed and defense and pitching, and then you staff it with a bunch of 300-pound, clumsy, slow-footed power hitters. It doesn't work that way.
I think that also the caller comes back to we were talking about this a little earlier. The caller comes back to the question of choices and how is it maybe we might change the political system that we have to give people more choice.
Well, and the choices I didn't think were irrelevant in 08. And I will tell you, in Iowa, I did end up voting for Nader, but I only ended up voting for Nader after I looked at the polling data and realized that that my state, Iowa, had gone blue completely. I mean, Obama was just was obviously going to win. And actually, I spent the last 2 weeks before the election. My son got me to do this because he was a campaign guy. But I was in all white towns, 99.9% white towns, talking to them. They put me out and had me talk to undecideds who were torn between McCain and Obama. And I kind of trashed McCain because I had done my research on McCain. I thought he was a really scary character. And let's not even say anything about Sarah Palin, who would have just been an absolute disaster and would have a good chance of ending up being in the White House. And those choices were not irrelevant. And I really think Noam Chomsky was right when he said McCain really threatened to be a loose cannon on the global stage and was doing very scary things, saying very unappealing things, particularly with regard to China. I do like the fact that Obama's been talking about denuclearization and bringing down nuclear arsenals and healing some of our relationships. I mean, I'm concerned about whether he's going to follow up on that. But McCain was a disaster. It would have been.
We'll see if we can real quick get one more caller here, line 3 in Champaign. But we'll have to ask you to be quick, but please go ahead.
Sure.
Yes.
just wondering, do you imagine that Obama believes his own rhetoric about why we are in Afghanistan? Juan Cole, who was here recently, had an interesting comment that if someone wanted to find a reason to keep the U.S. military tied up indefinitely in that part of the world, then subduing the Pashtun people would be a perfect way of doing it. The argument just seems to make so little sense. I'm wondering, do you think he believes the administration's own rhetoric in this direction?
Yeah, and I can probably give you about a minute.
You know, I just don't know. I can't figure it out. Some of this stuff is just sounding absolutely wacky. I always felt during the campaign that Obama, you have to walk this fine line, and this is a balancing act in American politics. And he had all this kind of peacenik kind of draft behind him with his liberal base in the campaign about Iraq, and he was going to get us all out of Iraq. And, of course, this opened him up to all sorts of attack from Fox News and from John McCain, from the Republican Party. It's always struck me that Afghanistan was there as his reserve kind of to make sure he could still sound like a chest-pounding macho militarist. So he's going to really kick butt over there. And it just struck me as strategically what he had to do. Now he's in, and he really seems to be escalating that whole situation. It has the potential to be his Vietnam and, in fact, be his Cambodia and his Laos, and to be a real disaster for him. And I agree with the caller. This could really be a fiasco.
We'll have to leave it there. I want to tell people, though, if you're interested in reading some more of the ideas of our guest, Paul Streich, you can look at his most recent book. The title is Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics. It was published last year by Paradigm. He's also a regular contributor to the ZNet website, so you can go see some of his writing there. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. It was great.